we showed, right, that assuming the real numbers have no holes, they're different than, say, the rational numbers. Not only that they have no holes, but that you can't list them all, even in an infinite list. Right? And now, what we're going to talk about today, sequences and series. So 2.1 introduces sequences and series. Some kind of fun examples. And then 2.2, we start digging in, making some precise definitions, actually proving stuff. So the main concept here will be the limit of a sequence. How do we actually prove stuff about that? And some of the questions raised in 2.1 are addressed only really in section 2.8. Now that's the last section of this chapter. The way this textbook is, the last section usually has a bunch of stuff where the proof is an exercise. You have to go through and prove a bunch of stuff. Right? So the exercise is at the end of this chapter, the last section. These will be one of the four group projects. So I'm going to have to randomly split you into four groups, and one of those groups will, they will have to present the earliest, but it'll be based on the earliest material, chapter 2 material. I spell out some stuff in the syllabus, so basically your group has to solve the exercises in writing and then give a presentation about the section for the class. So, why would we want to go to all the trouble of actually proving stuff? Well, it's because if you're just sloppy about it, you know, trouble can happen. This is a classic example of the problem. I have a bunch of numbers, just ones and alternating sign. And yes. Okay. And somebody wants to talk about, okay, add up infinitely many positive ones and infinitely many negative ones. What do they add up to? You want to say zero, right?
Is it zero or one? Depends on which one you stop on.
Okay, I see what you're saying there.
Or zero or negative one with you starting from negative one.
So this is negative one. This is zero. And I add another one. Now it's negative one. And that's zero. It's going to keep alternating, right? So why is zero better than negative one? I don't know. It feels more symmetric, I guess. The argument for it being zero is, well, hey, I could group them like this. Right? Group them as a bunch of zeros, so they should all add up to zero. But that's not the only way you could imagine grouping stuff, right? Why can't I reorder things, right? Addition is supposed to be commutative. So what if I was going to be, you know, devious and try to rearrange things in a really tricky way, okay? So here's what I'll do. I'll take two negative terms and a positive term. Alright. And I'll call this, X1. Alright. And then, let's see, I'll grab the next two negative terms and positive term. So, I'll take this, and I'll take that. And that'll be my X2. Alright? So, two negatives and a positive. And then I'll look out for the next one. Let's see. Well, there's my positive, and then I'm going to need... my two negatives, right? Let's see. I'll get one of them from there, and then the other one is going to be further out there. And then I could keep going, right? I could have, you know, this be grab some other terms from there, right? You could do the same thing. Right? So I could imagine some kind of really weird rearranging, right? Where each time I just grab the next available positive one and the next two available negative ones, and what would I get then? Well, every time each of these little x's, it adds up to negative 1, right? All of these x's add up to negative 1, so... like there's x3 right there, right? So, is it 0? Is it negative infinity? So you want to have some kind of actual definition, right? Not just a bunch of undefined dot, dot, dots. Right? You want to be able to say something, you know. We want to say, okay, according to our definition, this thing with the negative 1, plus 1, negative plus 1, the dot, dot, dots, we want to say, okay, that just doesn't equal anything. We'll make up a word for it, like it doesn't converge, it diverges, right? And basically what we're going to go with is the idea of this, where you add up the first however many terms, right? And then you keep adding another term. And as you add one more term, what happens to the subtotals, right? And here we can see what's happening. They oscillate between negative 1 and 0. And so it's turned out that that's the most useful way to think about these when you actually need to define them is, okay, just stop early and see what happens, right? And in this case, the answer is you oscillate between negative 1 and 0. So it doesn't make sense to really say it equals anything, because it never settles down on a single number, nor can you really say it goes off to positive infinity or negative infinity either. And we'll start with a precise definition of the limit of a sequence in 2.2, and then we'll go to series in future days. The really funny thing here, and this seems kind of like, you know, something that, are you ever really going to run into this? Well, the book has a nice example that's a little more plausible that, hey, you might actually care about this, right? The book has this nice example of a big matrix, but now it's a nightmare matrix because it's infinite in two directions. Maybe you've taken linear algebra, right? You know about matrices. So you imagine, okay, it's going to be negative ones on the diagonal forever. And then below the diagonal, it's zero. So it's this upper triangular matrix, right? And okay, so below the diagonal, it's all zeros. Fine. It's just, you know, they just go on forever. And then what happens above the diagonal? Well, above the diagonal, we have a bunch of 1/2s first, right? And then above those, we have some 1/4s. Then we'll have some 1/8s. And some 1/16s. And 1/32, right? You kind of see the pattern, right? And 1/64. So you can kind of imagine, you know, trying to, you know, add up the whole matrix, right? Well, but does that have any meaning, right? Or is it going to be, you know, the same kind of problem we had here, infinite in two directions. So if you had to kind of try and make up a definition, right, what would be your guess, you know, for roughly how could we try and decide what happens here, with the sequence of numbers, the kind of just one direction of infiniteness, right? We just said, okay, add up take the first one, then the second one, then the third one, just proceed like this and see what happens to the subtotals, right? So, is there some kind of analog of this we could try here? Some kind of analogous scheme? Can we break this up into pieces and call one piece the first piece, and then another piece the second piece, then the third piece, and then add those all up, see how the subtotals behave? How could we break it up? What are some of the pieces of a matrix you think about?
Pivot.
Okay. Well, not everything in a matrix is a pivot, though. So if we had to cover everything, what kind of pieces?
Columns and rows.
Columns and rows, yeah. Okay, so let's say we added up the columns. Right. Let's see. -1 and a bunch of zeros. And then what? Well, -1 and a bunch of zeros and 1/2. Okay. -1, then 1/2 is canceled and 1/4 is canceled, so you're left with -4. And the pattern continues. Like this one, -1, and we add the 1/2 to it, and that leaves us -1/2. Then we add the 1/4 to it, it leaves us -1/4. Add the 8 to it, it leaves us -8. Then add the 16th, you've got -16th. And then add the 32nd, now you've got a -32nd, so on. Okay. These, then we could add up all the columns, right? What would those add up to? Well, anybody remember something called a geometric series? Maybe maybe it got covered way back when. In theory, it should have seen in calculus 2, right? So, the answer is it adds up to negative 2. You could probably believe that, even if you don't know what the geometric series form is. Look at this. This is negative 3 halves, right? And then now add a fourth to that, so it becomes negative 7 fourths, right? Because this is 6 fourths and then another fourth. So now this is 14 eighths. Another eighth makes it 15 eighths. And then, that's 30 sixteenths, add another sixteenth. Looks like it's heading towards 2, I think. And in general, there's a... There's a pattern to it, which we can talk about, right? If you have, say, a number, I don't know, any number x, right? Let's say I add up a bunch of powers of x all the way up to, I don't know, x to the 17th, right? There's actually a simple formula. You just need x to the 5th. Minus x to the 18th over 1 minus x. As long as x is not 1. Bump up the last power by 1. And you can prove that it's just pure algebra. Just multiply both sides by 1 minus x, distribute, cancel a bunch of stuff, and then the equation is true. Right? And this is... You could change the 17 to a million, and then the 18 would become a million and one, right? So how about here? I'll make it 171, and then over here it becomes 172, right? You get the idea. So these things are similar. I guess there's just a factor of minus one in them, right? So that's how you'd actually prove that it goes to negative two. But... gross sums. Well, now it gets a little more tricky. Let's see. But you can use a geometric series to get at it. Here's the first row. 1 1/4 is 3/4. Tack on 8, you get 7/8. Then the 16th, you'll get 15/16. And in general, you're getting negative 1 plus something very close to 1. Right? So this should be 0. And then, actually, all the row sums are like that. Right? You have a sum of 0 if you add up each row, because all the rows look the same. It's just some rows have some extra zeros at the beginning. So you have some 0 in each row. So I guess these zeros would add up to 0, right? So, okay, yeah, something bad happened here, right? First we added up the columns separately, and then we added up those sums, and we got negative 2. Then we tried adding up the rows separately, and then their sums added up to 0, and we got a different answer. So, I didn't have to reorder things. Here I started getting tricky, right? I started reordering stuff. And you might, and here it's pretty clear, oh, there's this nasty oscillation, right? But this seemed pretty legit, right? Yeah. Okay, add up all the columns, and then add up all those totals. Okay. But it turns out that's actually not safe, right? Because if I do it this way, where I add up all the rows, and then add up those results, it gets something different. So, if you're adding up infinitely many things, you need to be careful, right? That's why we actually try to prove things. So we actually know that we're not just putting a bunch of nonsense on the whiteboard, right? Now, some proofs will be more rewarding than others. Right? Some things, we just end up proving something that was obviously true, and that's not very exciting. But other times, you know, building on the proofs of the obvious stuff, we're actually able to, you know, say something useful in non-obvious cases, right? You want to be able to prove something along the lines of, okay, that matrix was bad news, but if you give me some other kind of matrix of numbers, infinite matrix, and it satisfies, you know, assumptions A, B, and C, then I promise if you add up the rows and the columns, you'll get the same numbers, right? You would like to be able to actually prove something like that, so you could know, okay, this in this situation I'm safe, you know. In this situation, I don't know, right? And then, of course, the mathematician, he'll want to know, okay, well, why was I safe in each of those situations? The engineer would just want to say, okay, I'm safe, so I can use this formula. Let's use it. The mathematician wants to know, why did that formula work? And how far can I push this, right? Can I prove something along the lines of, okay, not only are A, B, and C good enough to make everything work out, but actually each of those three assumptions is necessary. So if you break any one of the assumptions, then, oh, there's a counterexample, right? So those are kind of interests of mathematicians. Generalize, right? Understand the general pattern. And part of generalizing will be take it to extremes, right? What are the weakest assumptions that'll keep your theorem true, right? And how do you know they're the weakest? Well, you have some counterexamples for when you go even a tiny bit weaker. Right? Okay. So what we start with then is, okay, before we get into series, let's think about sequences. Okay. So, a series like this, going to be defining it as a limit, defined as the limit of the sequence of partial sums. Okay? Where you just add up the first n numbers in your series and then you take n to infinity, right? Okay, so first we must define limits of sequences, right? Okay. Okay. Now, there's some notation that I always see some people getting stuck on, right? So, let's say I write this. Okay? How should I read this? The N is a subscript. It's written a little bit lower and smaller and off to the right. So you might say something like X sub N, okay? Or just XN if it's clear from the context. But XN is not X times N, right? Okay? And so we're not, it's a little bit low. And it's important that we make it clear in our writing that it's not XN, right? So if you write XN, you have a problem, right? Isn't it? And what does it mean, though? It's a function, okay? X is a function, okay? And its definition is just given by the formula on the other side of the equation, okay? X sub n is just notation for applying the function x to number n. So when you see the subscript, you want to think about how you work with functions, right? So, for example, applying a function, right, and then adding a number, or applying a function and then multiplying a number, it usually matters whether you add the number to the input and then apply the function, or whether you apply the function and then add the number to the output, right? So, likewise with sequences. If I have x sub a plus b, that's probably not the same as x sub a plus b, right? If you don't believe me, make f be the squaring function, right? You'll find lots and lots of counterexamples to the addition thing. I suppose here the squaring function's not a counterexample. Well, actually, no, yeah, even there, it's a counterexample, yeah. Yeah. So likewise, x sub a b is not the same as x sub a b, right? So you think of that subscript as just notation for application, right? As in apply function to some number, right? Okay. You know, I regret having to, spend all that time and board space on it, but I have seen a lot of homework assignments in my day that I see these elementary things come up, so I don't want to have to read that. So you should think of a sequence as just a function. The main difference is that usually with a sequence, right, we're thinking of the inputs as only being integers, right? And probably only positive integers, maybe zero, right? And once you start thinking about it as a function, then you can bring in some intuition from calculus, even pre-calculus, right? Okay, so sequences are functions usually with a special kind of domain, right? Usually it's the natural numbers, right? So starting at input 1, but then only allowing whole number inputs after that, right? Or maybe you throw in 0. It's some in special cases, you might have to start it, you know, at 2 or start at negative 5 or whatever. But it's usually just going to start at 1 or 0 and then keep counting up. So the point is the n, think of that as n for natural number, right? We're not intending to plug in pi here or something. That's the only difference. But you could imagine this as being a function where n was any real number, right? And let's see. If I had y equals 3x over x plus 5, let's see. Anybody want to tell me what the horizontal asymptote of this function is? Three. If you graph this thing, it'll look like this. It blows up at, you know, it's undefined at negative 5, but y goes to 3 as x goes to infinity. Right? Asymptote there. Talk about limits of a sequence, you're really just talking about horizontal asymptotes. Okay? And you can graph a sequence. Right? Could have done the exact same thing, but now just a discrete graph, right? Probably drew the graph upside down. No, I think I got it right. I think it's increasing. Let's see. Yeah, I got it right. Don't worry, it's fine. Okay. So for example, now think of it as we'll have x sub n will be 3n over n plus 5. Now the n will just be our horizontal axis, right? Okay, so plug in 1, it's no big deal. 3 sixths, right? Plug in 2, 6 tenths. Okay, so this is a half, so 0.5, 0.6, plug in 3, 9 eighths. Let's see here. 3 sixths. I got that wrong, sorry. It's 6/7. Okay. 9/8. And so on. So the next one is 12/9, right? And the idea is going off there. Okay, so. Maybe we need to draw. So we would believe maybe on a smaller scale, you know,
kind of zoom out, I guess bigger scale, right? We believe that the graph is going to look like what we expect from pre-CAPCAS, right? The horizontal asymptote. It's going to do something like this. It's supposed to get close to 3. But we need to actually come up with a meaning for that.
What does it mean as it gets close to 3?
So we have to take our intuitions and make them precise. So the idea, roughly speaking, is that when n is big, 3n over n plus 5 is close to 3.
Okay? Okay.
But what does that mean when n is big? And how close to 3? So turns out the best definition, the one that seems to work the best for us, and we've got, let's say, 150 years of history of math to back this up, is that you want to define it as the following. For every desired accuracy goal, and so we're going to say for every tiny number epsilon, but positive, we can get epsilon close and then we stay epsilon close. The catch is we just have to wait. So x sub n is eventually in the interval from 3 minus epsilon to 3 plus epsilon, right? So eventually the sequence will be inside this epsilon radius interval. And it will stay there. That's the key.
So I have to get some more writing.
Now, when I say xn is eventually whatever, what I mean is there are only finitely many exceptions. So there is some, think of it as a waiting time. You wait, I don't know, maybe you have to wait until the first million terms have passed, but then after that point, whatever property you want has become true and stays true. Okay? So, like with this epsilon thing here, the idea is okay, there's some epsilon, and I want to be eventually there. So, for example, if this is, if I say, okay, just wait for the first, I don't know, in this picture, I guess I have to wait. After starting at term 10, say, we're good, right? I promise you that at term 10 and beyond here, all of the points on the graph will be between 3 minus epsilon and 3 plus epsilon. Right? That's my promise. Right? I'm not making any promises about stuff before term 10, right? Some of those, you know, depending on what that epsilon is, right, they may not be close enough to 3. So, let's do a proof. So, proof of xn converges to 3, where xn is 3n over n plus 5. So here's the structure. Number one, for every epsilon, x sub n is eventually in that interval. Okay, so for every epsilon, and then number two, there is some waiting time such that x sub n is going to have our property, in this case being in the interval from 3 minus epsilon to 3 plus epsilon. Okay. So we need to show that for every epsilon, there is some n, right, such that you have this property for all lowercase n at least that big. So, I'm going to work backwards, all right? I'm going to start with my goal, all right? So, I need to do something for every positive epsilon. So, let's say I have some epsilon. I don't know anything about it, but it's positive. I need to prove something for all the epsilon. So, given a positive epsilon, what is my goal here? Right? My goal is that x sub n is in there. Right? Okay. It's between 3 minus epsilon and 3 plus epsilon. Okay, let's go up here. This is equivalent, logically equivalent. So this is true if and only if what? If the distance to 3 is less than epsilon. Okay. And now we're just going to do an algebra dance, basically. Right? Okay. So we're just going to look at the distance to 3. And let's see what we can do. Let's see here. 3 n plus 5. Now make it a fraction. Make it two fractions with common denominators, right? So 3 n plus 15, right? All I'm doing there, to get the 15, you're just multiplying by 3 and you distribute. Okay, so some stuff cancels. And you get negative 15 over n plus 5. Okay. Now, when you're dividing absolute values, the absolute value of the fraction is the same as the fraction absolute values, right? In either case, you're throwing away the minus signs. And, okay, so that's 15 over n plus 5. And this is for all natural numbers n, right? You might be a little worried about the denominator being negative, but we're thinking of natural numbers, right? There's no worry there. I mean, if you made n equals negative 5 or negative 20 or negative 100, yeah, there'd be a problem. But we're talking about n is 1, that makes it 6. And then n is 2 makes it 7. Right? There's no worry about negative stuff. Okay? So we're trying to say that we eventually get close to 3. Okay. And so now we have a nice formula for the distance to 3. Okay, so again, given somebody's demand, I want you to be epsilon close to 3, now we've got some algebra behind us now so we can build on it. Okay, so being less than epsilon away from 3 is the same as saying, 15 over n plus 5 is less than epsilon. Okay. And now we basically solve for n, right? How big does n need to be to guarantee we will be less than epsilon away from 3, right? It depends on epsilon. Okay. How do I solve for n?
Less than 1, which is like conjugate, the conjugate over the conjugate of the denominator.
Oh, like multiply by n. Can I just multiply by n plus 5? I mean, if I multiply, you're saying
n minus 5 over n minus 5.
Yeah. But I don't think that'll do it because if I do that, say here, I'd have two factors of n plus 5 and only one of them would get canceled. Okay? I think we really should multiply by n plus 5. Okay? Multiply by n plus 5, and we can do that without flipping the inequality because we're assuming we're talking about some positive integers here. So n plus 5 is positive. No worry there. Okay. Now what? Right. Still got to solve for n, right? Divide by the epsilon. My funny-looking Greek letter there, right? It's just some number. I don't know what it is because I'm trying to do a general argument for all epsilon. Right? But just, it's some number. Maybe that epsilon is 1 over a million. I want to be less than 1 over a million away from 3. Whatever it is. Now it's just some algebra. Subtract 5. You can do that with an inequality. Now, notice here. I divided by epsilon. Epsilon is assumed to be positive here. We're talking about distances, right? So I didn't flip any inequalities because I divided by a positive number. And then I just added negative 5 to both sides of the equation. So again, I didn't screw up the inequality. So there we go. So now all you got to do is just take our little result here, and now we can make a proof. All right. We kind of worked backwards, and now we can just turn it around. Okay, so here's how we turn it around. Okay, so therefore, given any positive epsilon, no matter how small, let capital N, just, I don't know, round this up to the nearest integer, whatever, right? And then you have exactly what you need. Right? If you wait this long, then beyond this point, there's never going to be a problem. You'll always be less than epsilon away from 3. Okay? Because we've shown that if lowercase n is strictly greater than this little formula here, 15 over epsilon minus 5, then just reading all these equivalencies backwards, right, we get all the way to this distance formula, and remember that in turn was the same as saying that x sub n was in our interval, right? That's the way it goes. So depending on what your epsilon is, you may have to wait a little time or you may have to wait a long time, but if it's any positive epsilon, eventually the sequence will get in this interval and it will stay there, right? It'll be between 3 minus epsilon and 3 plus epsilon. Yeah. It's kind of a pain, as you can see, to actually come up with a formula. Well, how long do I have to wait? Well, apparently, if epsilon is 1,000, we don't have to wait long at all, right? Because that's a huge distance. That's trivial, right? You're already there, even at n equals 1, and you'll stay there. But what if epsilon is small, 1 over 1,000, 0.001? Well, then you would need to wait until after term 14,995. But starting at term 14,996, you're good. I need to add a 1, didn't I? There's a little noise there. Because I suppose if I was exactly at, say, this, if this was a whole number and I was exactly on it, then I wouldn't quite satisfy that strict distance less than epsilon. So I'll just add 1 to be safe. Yeah. Then I think the proof works. So that's a very explicit, direct from the definitions proof. You actually come up with a formula that says, okay, you give me the epsilon, this is how long you have to wait. After that, the sequence is always epsilon close to our limit number, in this case 3. So sometimes you're asked to prove things directly from the definition, right? Meaning you don't use any shortcuts in terms of the book has this nice theorem that says blah, blah, blah. So you start right from the book's definition and then you just do some algebra until you get what you need. Right? Okay. do with direct. No shortcuts, right? We're going to see lots of shortcuts in the book, right? In future days, right? That's the next section, 2.3. Talks about limit laws. Very nice stuff, like it. If I take one sequence and add it term by term to another sequence, then if they both have limits, then I can just add the limits to get the limits of the new sequence. Stuff like that. But if you're just trying to do it direct, you know, then you've got to actually come up with this some kind of formula, right? In an explicit case like this for the wait time. And if it's a more abstract thing, like maybe you're asked to prove a limit law or something like that, well, you still may have to start from the definition. It's just that now the algebra won't involve actual numbers and formulas. It'll be stuff involving just unknown sequences and stuff. And I'll give an example of that. So that was one of the proofs. One of your homeworks will be to do some of these kind of direct from the definition proofs. Comments, questions? That's the basic idea. Start with the end goal, which is getting epsilon close, and then solve for n, right? You may need to simplify along the way and so on. Okay. Now, a little exercise from the book that we can do in class in the last 15 minutes. And sequential limits are unique. What does that mean? Well, that is prove that if I have some sequence and converges to, say, K, and it also converges to L, then K and L are actually the same number. So if you're looking at this and you have no idea where to start, think about the definition of limit, right? Okay. And what does it mean to say it converges to K? So you imagine some, you know, we have this kind of crude picture here. We don't know much about xn, but we know it has this horizontal asymptote K, right? And so we have these kind of epsilon statements, right? Eventually, right, everything is going to be between k minus epsilon and k plus epsilon, right? By the way, the book has a special you know, abbreviation for this kind of thing. Instead of having to write interval with, you know, the negative epsilon, the positive epsilon, they just write in the book V sub epsilon of K. Okay. I'm not terribly fond of that abbreviation, but you see that in the book. It's funny abbreviation. Nothing special about the letter V, really.
So what can we do with this?
Okay, so we have a similar picture for L, okay? So one problem I see here is that, okay, I've got this picture. It involves epsilons, right? For every epsilon, we're eventually epsilon close. But my goal, K equals L, doesn't say anything about epsilons, does it? How could I bring some epsilons into this? Right? How can I connect K equals L with epsilons? This was exercise 6. I've used different symbols, but this is my paraphrase of exercise number 6. Okay. How can I prove K equals L using a bunch of epsilons? If I can bring in the epsilons, then I can probably use the definitions to my advantage. There is the famous mathematician Terry Tao won a Fields Medal and all that. I've done some stuff with some of his graduate textbooks, and one of his little slogans is, "Give yourself an epsilon of room." Okay. And that's very applicable for doing proofs in calculus. A lot of times you can't prove something exactly. Instead, you prove it approximately. And you prove your approximations are as good as you need them to be. In this case, we're just going to prove that K minus L is smaller than epsilon for all positive epsilon, right? Well, if it's smaller than every positive number, then it's got to be zero, right? Because it's an absolute value. It's a distance, okay? And now that looks like a limit kind of thing, right? Because that's what the limit definition is. It's something about for every epsilon, blah, 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 right? So now we can just use... Now, here's what we'll do. Here's the idea. The sequence should get close to K eventually, and it should also get close to L eventually, right? So if it's close to K and it's close to L, then K and L should be close together, all right? And we can make that precise. Let's say you wanted to prove that K and L are less than 0.1 apart. Find an xn that's less than half of that, right? 0.05 away from K, and then also less than 0.05 away from L. Well, then the distance from those is at most, 0.5 plus 0.5, right? In fact, it has to be strictly less, right? So we're going to divide that epsilon by 2, right? Okay. So by definition of limit, there are some wait times, right? There's two eventuallys, right? So there are M and N. Those will be my wait times, such that what? Such that X sub N minus K is smaller than epsilon over 2 for all N, at least capital M, and X sub N minus L is also smaller than epsilon over 2 for all N, at least capital N. Okay? So if I want to get K and L close together, wait until the sequence is twice as close together as K and L. Right? And now it's going to work. Right? So now choose any N that's at least the maximum of those two wait times, right? If you have to wait a million terms for this to become true, and you have to wait a billion terms for the second statement to become true, okay, well, the bigger of those two numbers is a billion. So wait a billion terms, and then they're both true. And so then they're both true. So then you can say that K minus L, the distance from K to L, now we use the triangle inequality, is at most the distance from K to Xn plus the distance to Xn to L. So I'll write it suggestively like this, right? From K to Xn, and then from Xn to L. That's the same as this, right? Because if you multiply by negative 1, you'll change the absolute value. Right? But each of these two distances is less than epsilon over 2. Okay? So we have this kind of picture now of, we had xn for n really large, and we had K, and then we had L. We weren't sure they were equal yet, but those distances between them were shown to be each less than epsilon over 2. Right? Hence, the whole distance from K to L is less than epsilon. And so that's the end of our proof. So that's an example where instead of trying to prove a limit statement, right, I used a limit statement to prove something else. So this was more abstract, right? I didn't give you an actual number for K or for L. I didn't give you a formula for the sequence. But you could still take the definition of the limit involving all the epsilons, right? For every epsilon, the sequence is eventually epsilon close to the limit number. And then, in this case, we had to be a little bit more creative. Here it was just, okay, solve for n. Here you had to have the creativity to think to use something like the triangle inequality, right? Make k and l be close together by making them close to x of n. So it would be a little bit more creative to come to that step, but the main thing was using the definition. I guess I also have to be creative to think, oh, I can just prove that epsilon close for all epsilon. Definitely read sections 1 and 2, and I'll give you some homework problems to try out. If you want some more practice, you're welcome to try all the other exercises I don't assign, right? But let's say that, at minimum, let's do numbers 2 and 7, okay?
day four, right?